try to escape arrest after stabbing a grandmother to death with a butcher's knife. Taking legal action against an Essex hospital, the patient who claimed she was ignored by staff.
It's Boris here from Islington.
Mayor of London rings up to attack the Deputy Prime Minister on air. And Art Underground, why every tube station is getting its own picture. Hello, I'm Charlene White. A woman's been found guilty of stabbing a grandmother to death as she made her way to work. Nicola Edgington attacked Sally Hodkin with a butcher's knife in a random and brutal attack in Bexley Heath in October 2011. Edgington had taken herself to hospital that morning, but later left and went on to kill, as 1K Phillips now reports.
Moments after she stabbed her grandmother to death, Nicola Edgington runs into a nearby shop. Within seconds, officers in a police patrol car who are hunting for her are helped by a passing member of the public. Edgington then emerges from the back of the store and is arrested. As she is found guilty of murder for the second time today, questions are being asked about the alleged failures of the police, health workers and administrators. During the trial, the court heard that in November 2005, Nicola Edgington killed her own mother and was sectioned, but was released 4 years later. It was in October 2011 that she was brought to the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Woolwich after she'd argued with a taxi driver. After she told a nurse that she hadn't slept for weeks and was hearing voices, she was transferred to the Oxley's Mental Health Unit, which is in another part of the hospital grounds. While she was waiting to be transferred, she dialed 999 and told the operator that she felt she was dangerous and could kill someone. She made 4 further calls to the emergency services, pleading for help. In the last one, she said, "I'm dangerous at the moment. I'm very dangerous. You know, the last time I was feeling like this, I killed someone. The last time I was feeling like this, I killed my mum." She was eventually transferred to the mental health unit, but as nurses were preparing a bed, she ran off and took a bus to Bexley Heath. Edgington was captured on CCTV buying a kitchen knife before launching a ferocious attack on Kerry Clark at a bus stop. When Miss Clark bought her off, she headed for this butcher's. She grabbed a knife with a 12-inch blade from the block and carried on along the Broadway until she came across Sally Hodkin, who was on her way to work. She stabbed the 58-year-old with such force that her neck was cut completely open. Mrs. Hodkin died almost immediately from her catastrophic injury. An independent police complaints commission investigation has already been conducted, and there's been an internal review of the NHS Foundation Trust involved. The question being asked now by the families of the victims is, why wasn't she sectioned? Bronke Phillips, ITV News, Bexley Heath.
A pensioner from Hornchurch is taking legal action against the hospital trust after she says she was ignored by medical staff. The patient is one of 9 people planning to take Queen's Hospital in Romford to court. Today's development follows a scathing report into NHS care in Mid Staffordshire. Rhea Chatterjee has the story.
After wrongly being given epileptic medication by the pharmacy, our interviewee was rushed into the Queen's Hospital for emergency treatment. She spent 13 days there.
Speaking over the Queen's feet, what did you feel for
the time that you spent there? What would you say?
I would say that I would be scared, go back into hospital, into Queen's. I would be reluctant to recommend it to other people. I feel awful because being a nursing professional myself,
This is Andy speaking over Clean Feed 442 Channel 2 to Death Row.
Yes, and they're so desperate. And when I was moved into isolation, on 3 separate occasions, 3 days running, a staff nurse gave me the incorrect medication.
Just one of many mishaps. Feeling abandoned and ignored, she went on to contract the hospital bug Clostridium difficile, which was only detected after days of chronic diarrhea.
They ignored me for the first 4 days. And then I collapsed, and then all the doctors and nurses came round, and they got me stabilised, moved me to another ward where they had cardiac monitors, and during the late evening, the cardiac monitor kept going off. The staff nurse was so busy, she was trying to do the medication for the ward, and in the end, she just turned it off so that nobody said the alarm wouldn't go off anymore.
Our contact is one of 9 patients planning to take action against the hospital in Romford, claiming negligence and bad standards of care. In 2011, the Care Quality Commission criticised standards of care at the hospital, but the Trust say they've been improving standards on the front line. Senior nursing team members and matrons monitor the wards for care standards, and they say basic nursing principles have become a priority with all members of staff. In their statement, they apologise to those who have experienced poor care, acknowledging it as totally unacceptable, but with a commitment to improving services and increasing patient confidence.
What do you hope will come from the legal action?
I hope that nurses will be, will learn for it and learn from it and realise that patients are vulnerable. When you go into hospital, you're scared. You just want to be in safe hands and get well.
This claimant is looking for answers, why things went wrong, and assurances it won't happen again. Rhea Chatterjee, ITV News, Hornchurch.
A single mother with four children from Haringey is planning to appeal after she lost a high court case about changes to council tax benefits. The woman, who cannot be named for legal reasons, claimed that Haringey Council had not consulted properly on the changes, which means thousands of people in the borough could lose money. While council tax changes will come into effect in April, if you're unsure of what that will mean for you and would like more of an explainer, check out ITV.com/London. The Deputy Prime Minister was ambushed during a radio phone-in today by the Mayor of London. "Hi, Nick, it's Boris," is how Mr Johnson began his message to Mr Clegg. He went on to challenge Liberal Democrat MP over politicians' use of limos. The Mayor wants Mr Clegg to encourage his colleagues to use London's transport network instead. Our political correspondent Simon Harris has the full story.
For a politician looking to show off the common touch, it's the oldest trick in the book. Just jump on the tube. It's good enough for prime ministers, although they do risk being ignored. Even royalty has been known to get in on the act. But apart from the odd publicity stunt, is it realistic for the great and the good to give up their chauffeur-driven limos? One man who thinks so is London's bike-riding mayor. Last summer, Boris Johnson urged members of the International Olympic Committee to sacrifice their air-conditioned BMWs and instead experience the joys of the Jubilee line. Now he's gone one further and challenged government ministers. And he did it by ambushing Nick Clegg during the Deputy Prime Minister's weekly radio phone-in.
A caller now from Islington.
Hi, Nick. It's Boris here from Islington. I just want to ask you, when are you going to get all those government ministers out of their posh limos and onto public transport like everybody else?
Clearly, ministers, myself included, drive in cars, not all the time. I'm about to jump into a train to go up to Sheffield later this afternoon. But you know, I think the fact that we've cut the bill we inherited from Labour for ministerial cars by, I think it's around 7%, I can double check, which is a huge change. Is a big step in the right direction.
I think it's absolutely crazy that you've got so many of these guys, there are loads and loads of government ministers and indeed senior civil servants and quangocrats of all kinds, paid for by the taxpayer in limos in London, when by far the quickest way to get around is by bus or by tube.
Boy, how's that correct?
That might be true, but it's likely to take more than a few jibes from London's mayor to prise government ministers from their cars. According to security experts, with good reason.
Take those high-profile ministers who already have police protection. How are those police officers going to guarantee their safety routinely through the busy rush hour? It's not practical, it's not realistic, it's not safe.
There are many ways to lobby the government to alter course.
Nick, get them out of their limos. Boris, over and out.
Now, that trying to embarrass a minister on a live radio show is probably one of the less subtle. Simon Harris, ITV News.
And to hear Nick Clegg's full response to Boris Johnson during that phone-in, go to ITV.com/London. An Essex teenager has spoken out about the dangers of methadrone, the drug that's also known as meow meow or meth. It was sold legally as plant food up until 2010, but was then made illegal when more than a dozen people died after taking the drug. As part of the ITV Fixers project, where young people tell their stories, one user is recalling her experience. A warning, there's some graphic detail related to drug use in this report.
I'm Millie, I'm 17 and I live in Essex. When I was 14, I started taking methadone. Some people call it meow meow, some people call it MCAT, CCAT. I got into a bad relationship and I got influenced. And then from that day on, I just couldn't stop. At first, it felt amazing. I loved it. I loved every single minute on it. And then 6 months down the line, it just hit me. I couldn't carry on, but I couldn't stop.
It's difficult.
difficult really to know what's happening outside of the clinic, but in terms of what's sort of coming through the clinic door, I mean, methadone's been a massive problem.
I was doing over £60 a day. I've become self-centred, paranoid, and I ended up tooth grating my arm. I got admitted into a hospital, into a mental ward. I was in a 9-month relationship with a violent person just so I could keep doing this.
It made me feel good to start with, but then it just took control and I'd do anything to get it.
My fixes project is to make people know what methadone does to you. What was the cycle like?
Horrible. I'd wake up in the morning, do whatever I could to get someone, rob things, sell things.
How did your body react to it?
After like a month of taking it, I looked like a skeleton. I had spots everywhere, nosebleeds all the time.
How about you?
My nose is the main thing with the chemical in it. It just burnt a hole in my nose. I was on it for like 6 days straight, and well, I had a minor heart attack. Same night I got out of hospital, went straight back out and got back on it.
I know people that have been 12 and taken it. I know people at the age of 50 that take it. It's a cheap drug at the end of the day.
It's now the fourth most common drug in 16 to 24-year-olds. This was a drug nobody'd heard about 5 years ago. And that's one of the dangers with all of these new drugs, is that we don't quite know what the short or even the long-term harms might be.
What it can do to your body, what it can do to your brain, how it affects me still every day, even though I've been off it for 9 months. I hope that if people know what happened to me while I was taking methadone, that they'll never do it themselves.
And if you want more information about the issues in that report or the Fixers project, go to fixers.org.uk. You're watching the ITV News in London. Still to come, the critics have great expectations as a Dickens classic comes to the West End stage. But first, the mayor may have given a grilling to Nick Clegg earlier, but he gave an Olympic cycling champion an easier ride. Boris Johnson met up with gold medalist Laura Trott to unveil a route for a cycling festival this summer. Thousands of people are expected to get on their bikes for the Ride London event in August. Paul Bales has more.
True to his word, Boris Johnson arrived by bike. That was a clear statement, unlike his opening words to launch a major sporting event.
It's a fantastic feast of the Velocipede, ladies and gentlemen.
Roughly translated, it's a big bike ride, or four in fact, over one August weekend. One of them, 100 miles from the Olympic Stadium through Surrey and back to central London, will attract 70,000 cyclists, including the mayor himself. The real attraction for him is getting more people on bikes.
It's steadily increasing. In spite of a bit of bad weather, more and more people are getting on their bikes. It's a great way to get around. This is going to be the biggest mass participation cycling event in the history of the country.
So now, in the summer of 2013, who can forget those euphoric scenes when tens of thousands of people struggled to find space to stand to watch the Olympic cycle races? There are high hopes that these events 2013 will be equally successful for London.
Olympic-sized crowds are too much to hope for, but 200,000 visitors are expected to come to the capital, boosting the economy. And for Surrey, also an Olympic venue for cycling, there will be a welcome cash windfall too.
This is the first real legacy event that's been announced, and I think the Mayor of London and myself as leaders, we're showing that actually it's really important to take these events forward for the community of Surrey.
There's a place for amateurs. Cyclists are already registering for the Family Fun Race. The longer event will attract some of the world's top competitors too. Double Olympic champion Laura Trott has signed up for one race, but she's more of a sprint cyclist.
Basically, it's just a small circuit of, I think it's 1.6 miles, so however many k's that is, 2, 3. And then it actually runs along just outside here. And then it will be over like an hour, I reckon, with like 5 laps at the end. This event is going to be so good for like children, and for me, that's who I want to inspire. I just want to get them out and get them on their bikes and see them enjoying it as much as I do.
And what's the mayor's training programme? At the moment, he says, it is unprepared, but he adds, I will be a chiselled whippet by the end of it. Phil Bales, ITV News, The Man.
Next, the die-hard film franchise that just won't die. Bruce Willis is back with a fifth instalment of the popular action movie series. This time round, John McClane travels to Russia.
American?
Yeah. New York.
Are you a cop?
Yeah. It's gonna be a while.
How do you know I was a cop?
You don't look like a lawyer.
Well, it's the premiere this evening in Leicester Square of A Good Day to Die Hard. My reporter, Lucrezia Millerini, is there. Lou?
Hello, I am here in Leicester Square. How exciting. I haven't got John McClane, but I have got Jack McClane, or Jai Courtney.
Nearly as good.
Hello.
How you doing?
Now, I'm very well. How are you?
A little wet, but very good.
It's London.
It's a lovely evening for a premiere.
It really is. Now, you are obviously the son of John McClane, so that makes Bruce Willis your dad in this movie.
It does.
How's that feel?
Fantastic. He's a great on-screen dad.
Yeah.
Look, it's wonderful. A wonderful night. I mean, it's a great turnout. We're very proud of the film and very excited.
It is very exciting. It's hard to believe as well that we're standing here 2013 and it's been 25 years since the first Die Hard movie back in 1988. Now, you must have been a fan growing up of the Die Hard film, at all.
Yeah, I didn't manage to catch the first one in the cinemas. I was only two or three years old.
Oh, you weren't allowed to see that. No.
But no, I was a fan, of course. I mean, such an iconic franchise.
Yeah.
They're wonderful, good, fun, entertaining movies. And you know, this delivers right down our path.
I mean, what do you think the appeal is? Because this is the fifth one. There's talk of the sixth, maybe more.
Hopefully many more.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's, you know, John McClane's he's an everyman. He's a character that people can relate to, you know. If they don't sort of see themselves in him, then someone else, someone they work with. And he's always sort of managed to pull off these superhuman feats. So, it's entertainment. It's good popcorn stuff.
Oh,
I hope that, the franchise has a bright future.
What's it like working with Bruce on set then?
That's wonderful.
I mean,
Bruce is a lovely guy. Very cool, calm, kind of collected dude, and he loves to have fun, and you know, he's still doing it, still very passionate about what he does.
Does he put you through your paces a bit? Do you feel like you've got to keep up with him? He's been doing this for so long now.
He's pretty good. He leaves you to your own devices,
yeah,
in a way, but look, they had a lot of trust and faith in me with this, and I tried not to let the pressure of, you know, such a kind of an undertaking get to me, but just show up, get prepared, and have fun, and that's what we all did, and I think it shows on screen.
Yeah, and it is released on Valentine's Day, so how romantic.
It's a romantic film.
It is. You can go on your own and just not share the popcorn.
Exactly.
We like that. Thank you so much, Jay.
Thank you.
Bye. Thanks, Lou. Onto something that actually is romantic. It's a production that doesn't have cars blowing up and doesn't contain any guns or shoeboards.
Alex and crew at DEFRA NCR just calling to check the reverse.
Yeah. And TV series and is now coming to the West End stage.
You were just a boy!
So it's the first time the famous novel, one of Dickens' most popular, has been performed on stage in London. It'll be on at the Vaudeville Theatre. And to tell me more, I'm joined by Lucinda Dickens Hawkley, who is the great, great, great granddaughter of Miss Dickens, and also by Graham McLaren, the director of this new London production. Thanks very much for joining us. Lucinda, first of all, you look absolutely gorgeous.
Thank
it's not
you.
Something you wear every day.
No, I do feel a bit overdressed.
Of course, it's a gala premiere tonight in London,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
And why did you decide to, both of you, bring this particular book to the stage?
Well, what's extraordinary is it's never been produced in the West End before, so there seems like a great opportunity. And it's a great story, and, you know, it's a good idea to do it.
And is it hard or easy to bring something to the stage that's previously already been in films and has already been on TV?
Well, part of the issue is that you're coming to the theatre, so you're coming to see a show. If you really want the full Great Expectations experience, you read the book.
Yeah.
You read the book. That's what you do. But if you're going to the theatre, you'll see a show, which is not the same thing.
Now, what is it like for you, Lucinda, to have a member of your family who is just so iconic within this country because of his writing to still be relevant now and people still want to see his production, still want to read his book? What's that like for you?
It's amazing because he really is still relevant. That's what's been absolutely wonderful. Last year, 2012, we saw the bicentenary of Dickens' birth, and it's still carrying on. In fact, today, he would have been 201 years old. It's his birthday today, so that's why the gala premiere is tonight. But it's amazing because people constantly get in touch with me on Twitter or whatever to say how much they're enjoying his book. And that's just wonderful because he wrote from the heart.
And are you looking forward to the production?
Oh, yes, absolutely wonderful. I have seen it before because it's been travelling around the country and I've been giving talks there, but I have not seen the London production yet and I'm really excited. The stage set, costumes, honestly, they have to be seen to be believed. It's
so
amazing.
Are the different
Dickens family going en masse tonight to go to the garden?
Actually, no, there's lots of different things happening on Dickens' birthday, but I've got my sisters there and my niece and nephews, and I'm really excited. They've not been to anything like this before, and they are so excited.
And so, is there anything special that you've put in for this particular production?
No, we had a great time making it. We were inspired as much by the text as we were inspired by the drawings and the illustrations and these crazy little grotesque people with like one large eye and a cauliflower ear and tiny little spindly legs. And we've had fun making the show look a bit like the illustrations coming to life.
And is there any more pressure having someone like Lucinda in the wing?
Much more.
I'm really horrid to them. I can imagine him quite a tough monster.
So Savage, because Great Expectations is one of Dickens' darkest novels, and this, the grotesque, really comes across. It's wonderful.
Well, Lucinda and Graham, you both have a wonderful evening.
Thank you.
Night, and hopefully lots of people come along and go to the experience as well.
Thanks very much. Thank you. Okay, time to see what's ahead on the ITV News. Here's Mark Austin.
Coming up, the trial begins with a fugitive gunman accused of luring two police officers to their death. Dale Cregan repeatedly shot PCs Nicola Hughes and Fiona Bone before throwing a grenade at them. Also, another embarrassing U-turn from the government, this time on GCSEs. The exams are here to stay, but they will be made tougher. And an emotional Stuart Hall vows to fight sex abuse charges and regain his reputation.
The last 2 months of my life have been a living nightmare.
For more on that and the rest of the day's news, join Juliet Chingham and me at 6:30.
And Martin's here with the weather and some good news for those that were at risk of flooding.
Well, yeah, it was only last week we were marking 60 years since the Canvey Island floods. I remember that. There was 58 people died in those floods. It was a huge tidal surge and it caused great devastation. 307 people died in the UK. And it was the first time the government sort of got their head together and thought, we need to do something about flooding. And it was off the back of getting those thoughts together that the Thames Barrier was built in the 80s, which is obviously really important. There it is, there's the Thames Barrier. It's very important protecting the capital. And today the government announced another huge wad of money, £294 million, and a large chunk of it is going to go to London.
We're spending £16 million improving the tidal defences for London, which will see greater protection for £200 billion worth of property in this city. So this is a really important announcement for our capital.
And the important thing there is you're not talking years. You've got to sort of be planning for decades ahead because they've got to think about changes in sea level, things like that. So it's really important that they get that investment in now. But onto more short-term things like tonight's weather. No chance of flooding, but it is going to be staying very cold.
If you want to stay cold, get in the pool. But if you can reach, I will see you at the beach.
So staying dry for most of us tonight, just with the odd shower though. And then tomorrow it's going to be cold, chilly and cloudy as well. So those showers I was talking about are just nipping in towards the west of the patch. Could be quite sleety as well over some of the higher ground. But for most of us, it is going to be dry. There are some clear skies, particularly out to the east, and that means temperatures are going to drop quickly down to about freezing, so quite a chilly night as well. And then a chilly start to tomorrow morning. The wind is easing off, which will help with temperatures, and a little bit of sunshine out towards the east. But that cloud is thickening again from the west, and it will thicken into the afternoon, bringing with it a few more wintry showers, I'm afraid. And then things get interesting into the weekend. By Sunday and Monday, we could be seeing some snow. I'll see you later. Goodbye.
Finally tonight, above ground, there's no shortage of galleries in London. Well, now we'll be able to see art we get on the tube as well. 270 stations on the network are getting their own individual pieces of art. The commission called Labyrinth is one of a series of events to mark the 150th anniversary of the London Underground. Artist Mark Wallinger has created a unique enamel panel for each station.
What's the thing about the tube map is that it's all being a bit of a puzzle until one becomes familiar with it. And then, yeah, I think the lovely thing about these, I mean, they look a little brain-like, and so they represent the organ that is the one that contemplates this journey.
Well, joining me now is Tasmin Dillon from the organisation Art on the...
It's Paul and Simon. Can you hear this programme okay?
Well, we want to
start
the 150th anniversary of London Underground with a really ambitious commission. Art on the Underground actually established 10 years ago in 2000, so 13 years ago in 2000, and we've been making projects across the network in that time to enhance customers' journeys. But for this particular landmark occasion for London Underground, we felt it deserved something that would cross the network and really be represented in every station.
Now, each piece is quite similar. I think we can see some pictures of it now, and it's circles and it's you know, lines, which essentially this very print can be taken in so many different ways.
Hi, Alex, it's MCI here. Just to confirm, you hear the reverberation.
Thanks. Yes. Certainly the first thought that came into Mark Wallinger's mind, I'm sure, he was a no-brainer of a choice for us as far as the artist is concerned. He's born and bred in London. He's made two artworks that are based on the tube itself already. One taken at made at Art at Angel Station, and one at on the Circle Line. And he came up with the idea of labyrinths.
Yeah.
And wanted to do a unique design of these labyrinths for every single one of the 270 stations.
Well, as he said, this, you know, Art on the Underground has been going for 13 years. I think a lot of people don't really realise just how frequently art is popping up on the Underground. I think you brought these in for us, like tube map covers, which I'm sure quite a few people have seen. I think we can see that on the camera. Quite a few people probably have picked up at stations all across London and not realised that they're actually commissioned, you know, quite famous artists have done them. So there's so many things that are happening art-wise. What more can we look forward to?
Well, as well as Labyrinth, we've actually launched the project with 10 stations first of all. You'll be able to see those at King's Cross, Baker Street, Embankment and other stations. And they'll be rolling out, we'll be able to see all of them by July. And
Alex, it's Freddie.
Wherever your local station is, you'll have one.
Are you happy with the question and the link then? So that you can see it. Food Foundation, as he confirmed tonight, Tesla the Meat can send a Findus lasagna shows it was mainly horse meat. The beef ready meals are made up of more than 6% horse. Alex Forrest is at the Department of Food and the Environment. Alex, an astonishing turn of events now.
That may crop up at a tube station near you. Go to i3.com/London. That's all from the London team for now. We're back with the latest after ITV News at 10. Now, though, it's time to join Mark Austin and Julie Etchingham for the national and international news.
Lured to their death by a fugitive on the run, a man goes on trial for the murder of two police officers. Dale Cregan is accused of a gun and grenade attack on Nicola Hughes and Fiona Bone.
Also tonight, a marriage in meltdown, astonishing recordings of calls between Hune and his former wife.
I absolutely deny you took my points.
You deny I took your points when you made me take them. Oh, what?
Now it's lasagna. Findus admits horse meat is found in one of its products.
And a U-turn on GCSEs. The exams are here to stay after all, but they will be made tougher.
This is ITV News at 6:30 with Mark Austin and Julie Etchingham.
Good evening. A court heard today how a fugitive gunman lured two female police officers to their death by reporting a bogus burglary. The prosecution said Dale Cregan then lay in wait and shot them repeatedly when they arrived.
The families of PCs Nicola Hughes and Fiona Bone sat in court as the jury were told that Cregan then threw a grenade towards the victims. Martin Geisler reports on the first day of the trial at Preston Crown Court.
Shortly after first light this morning, a convoy of police cars and prison vans made its way along the motorway from Manchester to Preston. In one of the vans sat Dale Cregan, the man charged with the murders of Constables Nicola Hughes and Fiona Bone in September last year. His trial at Preston Crown Court takes place amid a massive security operation. 150 police officers surround the building, some armed with automatic weapons. Spotters have been placed on the court roof. As the trial began, the 29-year-old sat impassively in the dock as Nicholas Clark, QC, outlined the case against him. The jury were told that Cregan had deliberately lured the two officers into a trap and then murdered them. The court heard that Cregan called the police to report a burglary at this house in Hattersley, Greater Manchester. But when Constables Nicola Hughes and Fiona Bone arrived to investigate, he killed them in an attack that involved a gun and a hand grenade. The jury was told Cregan emptied a full extended magazine from his Glock pistol as he fired at the constables. The coming weeks will be harrowing for their families, who arrived at court together this morning. Cregan is also charged with the murders of Mark Short and his father David last summer, and the attempted murder of Sharon Hark. The jury was shown this CCTV footage, which it's claimed shows Cregan throwing a grenade into the garden of the Harks' home, then running off, carrying a handgun. Seconds later, the grenade detonates. Alongside Cregan in the dock sit nine of his alleged associates, charged either in connection with the murders or with assisting an offender. All 10 men deny the charges against them. Their trial is due to last up to 12 weeks. Well, just a short while ago, that convoy of prison vans and police cars left Preston Crown Court amid the same tight security as it arrived, carrying Dale Cregan and some of his co-accused back to prison, where they're on remand. Tomorrow, we expect the prosecution to finish the opening address to the jury. It's likely it will include further details of that day in September last year when Constables Nicola Hughes, and Fiona Bone died in Hattersley, Greater Manchester.
Martin, thank you very much indeed.
Astonishing recordings of a row between former Cabinet Minister Chris Hume and his ex-wife were heard in court today. Vicky Price is on trial for allegedly taking his speeding points, which she claims he forced her to do. She also made a further allegation that the former Energy Secretary once put pressure on her to have an abortion because the pregnancy was bad timing for his career. Our political correspondent, Romilly Weeks, reports.
By the end of this case, there might be nothing that remains private about the marriage of Vicky Price and Chris Hume. Giving evidence herself today, she said she'd always felt it was morally repugnant that he'd got her to take his points after being clocked speeding in his personalised BMW, and after the breakup, tried to get him to confess in these extraordinary calls released today.
Look, for heaven's sake, I absolutely deny you took my points.
You deny I took your points when you made me take them? Oh, what? Who are you going to deny this, stupid?
Trick. It is the oldest trick in the book.
Yeah.
To try and stand up a ludicrous story.
A ludicrous story? All right. Do you not remember that the entire family, knew that I took your points?
There is no question, all right?
There's no question of what, Chris. Excuse me, we used to be husband and wife. I took your points. You know that so well. I am prepared, though, to lie for you, as I have done all along. But they're pressurizing me all the f***ing time. I can't even get home without having people outside my f***ing door, whether it's to do with your f***ing man or whether it's to do with your f***ing points. And it's got nothing to do with me.
Vicky Price's defense is that she was forced to take her then husband's points, describing him as a pretty strong and bullying character.
Hello, Alex. You're next. Mark will say official correspondent Alex Voice at the Department of Food and the Environment. Alex, an astonishing turn of events now.
And she broke down in tears that she'd regretted ever since.
Chris Hume has already pleaded guilty.
Happy with that, Alex.
His ex-wife also...
Slight change, Alex. Yet more revelations about our food.
During half-time in a World Cup match before heading off to the gym.
Yet more revelations about our food.
Yet. Romilly Weeks, ITV News, Southwark Crown Court.
The Food Standards Agency confirmed tonight that tests on the meat content of Findus lasagnas show it was mainly horse meat. The beef ready meals apparently contain more than 60% horse. Our political correspondent Alex Forrest is at the Department of Food and the Environment tonight. Alex, yet more revelations about our food.
10 seconds.
Next, thank you very much.
The Education Secretary was accused of a humiliating U-turn today after he abandoned his controversial changes to GCSEs. Michael Gove said he now conceded the proposals were a bridge too far.
But another reason the plan for an English baccalaureate certificate was sunk was because the Liberal Democrats refused to support it. Our political correspondent Carl Dinnan has our report.
One of the criticisms of Michael Gove's plan to replace GCSEs was that it didn't contain enough art subjects. But there were other concerns too, and today Mr. Gove listened to his critics and returned to the drawing board. He'll now reform GCSEs rather than scrap them.
Well, one of the proposals that I put forward was a bridge too far. My idea that we end the competition between exam boards to offer GCSEs and core academic qualifications and have just one, wholly new exam in each subject, was one reform too many at this time.
Labour seized on the U-turn.
Under this government, the words GCSE and fiasco seem to be linked indelibly. This is a humiliating climb down.
Teachers seemed relieved that GCSEs would stay and be reformed after a period of uncertainty.
It's been a real mess.
I, in common with most school leaders, really welcome the fact that we're going to reform GCSE. They're already good qualifications. They have real value in the marketplace, and I'm delighted that we're going to reform them and make them even better.
Those reforms will mean less coursework and internal assessment, more emphasis on rigorous exams.
So has Mr. Gove's career been damaged by this? Well, perhaps not as much as the Labour Party might like to think. He remains one of the government's leading reformers. In fact, the winners today could be the Lib Dems, who are claiming credit for forcing the U-turn. Carl Dinan, ITV News, Westminster.
Still to come tonight, a defiant Stuart Hall vows to fight sex abuse charges.
The last 2 months of my life have been a living nightmare.
And the foster carers worried about the impact of the government's bedroom tax. Those stories and more when we come back. Welcome back. The former It's a Knockout presenter, Stuart Hall, said today he'd considered suicide after being charged with rape and indecent assault, but the love of his family had saved him. He was speaking at Preston Magistrates Court, where he faced allegations of assaulting 10 girls under 16 and the rape of a woman. Martha Fairley reports.
This was Stuart Hall's second appearance at Preston Magistrates Court, this time facing 15 charges, including the alleged rape of a 22-year-old woman in 1976, and the indecent assault of 10 girls, the youngest, aged 9.
The allegations are pernicious and callous and cruel and above all spurious. I'm not guilty. The last 2 months of my life have been a living nightmare. I've never gone through so much stress in my life.
The 83-year-old broadcaster hosted It's a Knockout in the 1980s.
This royal diadem, this scepter isle.
But the man famed for his colourful commentaries admitted only his family's support has kept him going.
Fortunately, I have a very loving family, and they're very supportive. And I think, but for their love, I might have been constrained to take my own life. I was a healthy 83-year-old, but I'm now incubating a heart complaint, and I'll be very lucky to survive another couple of years.
Stuart Hall was allowed to return home on bail, but is due to appear in court again on the 1st of March. He says he intends to defend himself and to regain his honour, his reputation, and more than ever, his life. Martha Fairley, ITV News, Cheshire.
The chairman of the inquiry into the scandal at Mid Staffordshire NHS Trust, where hundreds of patients died needlessly in its care, told ITV News today it was not his job to demand resignation.
The family today met the author of the report, Robert Francis, and repeated calls for the head of the NHS to quit. Our correspondent, Geraint Vincent, reports now from Stafford.
Back in the cafe where the campaign to change the NHS is being run, the sons and daughters and brothers and sisters of those who died in the Stafford Hospital scandal are still meeting, still working.
We want people who have failed in their role and failed to protect patients to resign and to promise to never work in public office again.
I'm not ashamed of being in my job today.
The resignation of NHS Chief Executive Tony Nicholson is the one they'd most like to see at the end of an inquiry into the total failure of the NHS to care properly for hundreds of people at Stafford Hospital. The man who led that inquiry has returned to Stafford to meet once again with their family.
It's the worst thing I've ever heard of in the career spanning nearly 40 years. And the suffering of these poor people is absolutely appalling. There is no excuse for it.
But the people you're meeting with this afternoon have a campaign, Cure the NHS, and the keystone of that campaign is that when things go wrong, someone's got to take responsibility. The last chief executive of the NHS resigned because he spent too much. Hundreds of people have died here, and nothing's happened.
I don't think it's ever the job of an inquiry chairman to decide that people ought to resign or be sacked. That it is, as I say, it's not a trial.
Since the report into what happened at Stafford, investigations have been launched into higher than expected mortality rates at 5 other NHS trusts in Colchester, Basildon, East Lancashire, Blackpool and Tameside.
The system failing about Stafford was so serious that we can't be sure that the system would discover a Stafford somewhere else, and that's why I've made many of the recommendations that I have.
So it was another meeting for the Stafford families
didn't get all they want.
It's a journey for us which will never end. It's just a journey with challenge after challenge after challenge.
And so their campaign goes on. Here I'm Vincent, ITV News, Stafford.
Well, let's cross now to our deputy political editor, Chris Schiff at Westminster, who has details of six other trusts where the death rates are currently a cause for concern. Chris, what more can you tell us about this?
Well, Julie, there are currently a total of 11 NHS trusts where mortality rates are a cause for concern. Yesterday we found out about five, which will be investigated because they were at the bottom of the list for 2 years running. We've identified the six others where the mortality rates were substantially higher than expected last year, and between them, there were 1,300 more deaths than expected. Now, those six trusts are Walsall, Mid-Cheshire, Aintree University Hospital, Northern Lincolnshire and Goole, Wye Valley in Hereford, and Buckinghamshire. Of course, we should be careful about these figures. They do take account, for example, of deprivation in the area. They don't take account of palliative care. But nonetheless, these figures are a cause for concern, and they may well have an investigation of their own launched by the Health Secretary.
Chris, thank you.
The Defence Secretary told ITV News today he was optimistic the Taliban would enter into peace talks within months. Philip Hammond is on a visit to British troops in Afghanistan as the UK prepares to withdraw combat forces by the end of next year. Our international correspondent John Irvine is there with him.
What lies ahead is the long road home. After a campaign of a duration not seen since Napoleon, Britain's war in Afghanistan is winding down. The paraphernalia and detritus of 11 years of fighting is being sifted through. A myriad of equipment is being repatriated. 80 tons of it leaves here every other day.
It's the light at the end of the tunnel. It is getting brighter. You know, the plan is there. Timelines are there, and we are looking to take equipment home.
And soldiers will soon be able to follow because there are fewer and fewer British outposts here, with just 24 left. The Defence Secretary went to this one because it gave him a commanding view over the Helmand River Valley. Beside the base is an old fort used by the Russians in the 80s and by the British a century before. Unlike its predecessor of the 1800s, the British Army of today is undefeated. Indeed, right now it's in the ascendancy in the fight against the Taliban. However, it's not victorious, which raises the question, what happens when we leave here? That depends on the capability of the Afghan army. Mr. Hammond was here in part to encourage senior Afghan officers. It also depends on possible negotiations with the Taliban, which the Defence Secretary predicted would begin soon.
I think there's quite a lot of reaching out with messages to the Taliban. At the same time, they're feeling